Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with William P. Jones. His latest book is The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. He's professor of history at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, specializing in labor history and civil rights. His first book, which we did not talk to him about, but which was really fascinating for those who read it, was called The Tribe of Black Ulysses, African-American Lumber Workers in the Jim Crow South. And William Jones, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's great to be on, Mark.
That first book was good. That's something I experienced, so I was really enthralled by that book. But
you mean you experienced the lumber industry?
Right, with the pulpwood workers on the border of Alabama and Mississippi.
Oh, right, yeah.
Many years back.
Yeah, yeah. That's another fascinating story.
Yes, it is. So, but I'm really, this is an interesting book, because the tact you take in this book, and folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Or log on to our Facebook pages and see if you have a comment there. Was, in a general sense, starting with the power of the labor movement and the labor agenda in the March on Washington, but very specifically around A. Philip Randolph and many others who we'll talk about, and Bayard Rustin, the power of black labor, which is something little talked about.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a common story with the march is that the AFL-CIO, the official of Labor Federation, didn't endorse the march, and that's been taken to be, you know, the, sort of the end of the story, that that labor did not come on board. But the story that I found in the research for this book that really fascinated me, you know, after this is the second book I've written, I have a PhD in history, and I didn't really know how central black union activists were to building and really initiating the march. A. Philip Randolph is the best known. But he was the president of the Negro American Labor Council, which was a network of several thousand black union activists. They were elected officials or staffers in local unions in cities across the country, mostly in the North, but also some in big cities in the South. And they were really the people who were responsible for initiating and then laying the groundwork for the massive march and they sort of have faded into the background.
One of the things that let's take us back in history for a moment before we jump into the 1963, as you did in this book, because you bring in parts of A. Philip Randolph and the Industrial Workers of the World and the Socialist Party and other things is connections to that most people don't know about.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I had to do it became clear to me with the book is that I had to start long before 1963 with, and really the beginning of the book traces A. Philip Randolph's early years, which go back to the First World War when he moved to Harlem from Florida and became active in the Socialist Party and the union movement, and in this sort of radical ferment that I think it became clear to me that there was, you know, not direct connections to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, but very strong and important connections, both personal and organizational, that went into building, in a sense, you know, a very long process of building a mass movement.
The issue of A. Philip Randolph is a complex one, because some people saw him as too radical. As you write, other people saw A. Philip Randolph as too conservative. And in point, when you write about the complexities around what would have been the first march on Washington in 1941.
That's right. I mean, he, by 1963, he was 74 years old. And I think one thing that's really remarkable about him to me is his ability to remain at the center of political activism throughout a very long life, and to change over time and to adapt over time while maintaining a commitment to sort of his bedrock principles of social justice, economic justice, racial equality, and democracy. His really strong belief in democracy. As he said at the March on Washington, the primary goal of the movement was to create a world in which the value of the human personality comes before the value of private property. And it's a very, you know, a very simple but profound statement. So I think that over time, he came into conflict with a lot of different activists over a number of different issues that that led to him often being called, you know, conservative, more often being called too radical. The issue in the first March on Washington in 1941 that really gained him, created a lot of controversy, was he actually called that march off at the last minute. President Franklin Roosevelt issued an executive order banning employment discrimination in the defense industries, and this was really the primary goal of the march, but it wasn't the only goal of the march. The march was also focused on segregation within the armed forces, and Roosevelt didn't do anything to address that. So when Randolph called it off, he said, you know, we got most of what we wanted, and we can still push, but we need to call it off and shift our focus. And he got a lot of flack, particularly from younger activists who believed that they should just keep going.
Like Adam Clayton Powell, who later became a congressman.
Right, that's right. Adam Clayton Powell, who was later a congressman. Richard Parrish, who was an important activist, who would become an important activist in the American Federation of Teachers. And both of them, he was the leader of a New York State coalition of college students in New York State, and he and Adam Clayton Powell really opposed the idea of calling off the march.
Well, one of the things, I mean, I think this history is important is that, A, I think people don't realize that there was this burgeoning and really powerful in many ways black labor movement in America in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Built around not just people like A. Philip Randolph, but as you write about people we don't talk about in today's history, whether it's an unknown like Ernest Callaway or Cleveland Robinson, even people like Ella Baker and others who were really deep, really, I mean, it was a transformative movement that we don't really cover.
That's right, and it really was essential to the ability of civil rights activists to mobilize on that level. I mean, it was the unions that were able to put up the money to reserve buses and trains, to hold those buses and trains, to sell tickets on the buses and trains. So the unions would made up books of tickets and sold them to their members, and then had their members go out in the neighborhoods and sell them to get on the buses to go to Washington. And so I think really, you know, what I saw in this story was that none of this would have happened if these not just unions, I think primarily unions, but also really well-organized civil rights organizations, women's clubs, that they were really essential to the ability of people to mobilize on that level.
Talk a bit about that. That's the other thing. I always say her first name right. You write about Maida Springer from the Garments Work Unions and other women. Talk about that black women's movement that also we don't hear about. During the civil rights movement, black women were pushed to the back in many ways, especially in the marches, but they clearly were not in the back.
No, that's right. Yeah, and there's several levels on which this was the case. One was within civil rights organizations and unions. Women played very important roles, often leadership roles. I mean, Maida Springer was an important leader of the Garment Workers Union, for example, which was a largely female union. Almost all of the members were women. But it was led and dominated by men. But Maida Springer was able very early on, starting in the 1940s, to rise into the ranks of the union, gain very important leadership positions. Another woman that's really been lost in this history is Anna Arnold Hedgman, who was the leader of the YWCA.
Which was what? What was the YWCA?
Well, the Young Women's Christian
Association,
the female counterpart
to
the YMCA. And this was an interracial, you know, mostly white organization, but they operated chapters in black communities across the country and really became a training ground for many important women activists in the civil rights movement who started by really trying to push the YWCA in a more egalitarian measure or direction, both in terms of addressing economic inequality. And the YWCA, starting in the 1920s, became a really powerful force for addressing poverty in both black and white communities. And in the 1940s, the YWCA really took on the issue of racial inequality. And now, I mean, even now, it remains a really important force for fighting racism. And so people like Anna Arnold Hedgman rose out of this movement where they, you know, gained skills in running organizations and organizing demonstrations and things, and then used that as a stepping stone into the civil rights movement. So in 1946, A. Philip Randolph recruited her to head the National Council for a Permanent FEPC, which was a national campaign to pass fair employment legislation, legislation making it illegal to discriminate against an employer. And so he tapped her as the director of this organization. She was probably the first person or one of the first people that he went to when he decided to revive the March on Washington in 1963. She was the only woman on the organizing committee of the 1963 march, and she actually urged him to invite a woman to be in the official leadership of the organization or of the mobilization, and he refused to do that, and that led to a really important split within the movement.
Now, William Jones, before we, in a few minutes, we have 3 minutes left in this segment. Talk about the role these people played, and people like A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, in the march in Washington itself in 1963, and how they really were the backbone behind it.
Well, because they had these networks going back to the 1941 march, and even before that, going back for Randolph and people like Hedgman back to the 1920s and 1930s, they were able to very quickly start to mobilize a march to the extent that by the time they actually started to publicize the march and look for much more sort of mainstream support, they really had the march well organized already. So they were able to call the shots, really. And I think this was very important in terms of being able to organize a massive march and involve many organizations with many different political beliefs without straying from their central idea that what was needed was very strong civil rights legislation to enforce racial equality, coupled with very powerful federal action to ensure economic justice. And this remained the sort of central idea of the march and reflected, I think, in the slogan of the march, for jobs and freedom.
Well, what I hope you'll do, William Jones, over the next few weeks and months after we do this, leading up to the March on Washington on the 24th and more, that you'll rejoin us to really kind of reflect on what this means for now in the 21st century. I appreciate you taking this brief time today and look forward to a longer session with you soon.
Oh, that sounds great. I'd love to do that.
Thank you so much. William Jones's book, The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. We're going to take a very brief break and come back with Rose Aguilar as we look at what's happening with protests and social movements around America. Stay with us.